Claiming that one opponent is running on seniority and the other on ancestry, Democratic challenger for the United States Senate, Michael Beasley, says it's time for a change. Beasley says that Gravel and Greening are much the same.
The only difference is in personal style. Greening says he's mellow, and he claims Gravel is too harsh. Who cares? I am a populist who wants to bring the government back to the people.
By bringing the government back to the people, Beasley doesn't mean to increase government. He wants to limit it while having a stronger defense posture.
Only a strong America can preserve world peace.
Okay, now, both of those positions are not necessarily democratic positions. You're talking, when I hear limit government, I hear libertarian. When I hear strong defense posture, I hear both libertarian and Republican.
Oh,
why are you running as a Democrat?
Oh, I'm running as a Democrat because since I started to vote 25 years ago, I've always registered and voted as a Democrat.
Two positions that the Democratic National Democratic Party recently came out espousing were support of the Equal Rights Amendment and homosexual rights. What are your positions on those two areas?
On the ERA, the Equal Rights Amendment, when it first came out a few years ago, I was very enthusiastic. I was delighted to see equal pay for equal work. And then apparently there are numerous injustices in many state laws, mainly in regards to inheritance, where widows or divorced people cannot get justice in the division of the money. So it looked like an excellent idea, and then suddenly out of the blue we have all these additions to it. For instance, now some lawyers are saying this means that women can be drafted, have to be drafted. So I'd say equal pay for equal work and away with injustice, but no draft for women, because when you draft women, what it means is that you're taking the homemakers, the guardians of our future, and putting them in a situation where perhaps an entire generation could be wiped out.
Beasley opposes the draft for men as well, calling it social experimentation, a means for reducing unemployment. And if the Equal Rights Amendment means a draft for women, he's opposed to it.
If it does not mean a draft, I see no harm in it.
Beasley, who has never before run for an elective office, also sees no harm in trying.
If I didn't think I had a very excellent chance of running, why bother? It's a lot of work running for public office, and the idea of doing it as a frivolity is very strange thinking.
Michael Beasley, a Democratic candidate for U.S. Senate, whose thinking is different than his opponent's. I'm Karen McPherson in Fairbanks.
That's a furnace that you hear, along with the exhaust system, combustible air. It's a noisy place.
Furnace system for what?
For smelting precious metals.
How precious?
Gold and silver, mainly.
There's a mining boom going on around Fairbanks, and more people than just the miners are benefiting from the mini gold rush. Dan Barrett is the field manager for Delta Smelting and Refining Company Limited in Fairbanks, a firm based in British Columbia that specializes in assaying, smelting, and refining precious metals.
In the refining process, there are two stages. The first is taking the raw placer, melting it down into a solid bar. The gold and silver is mixed equally in it. The size bar we produce depends upon the size of the customer's shipment to us. After that, then the gold and silver is actually parted, and that's the refining process.
To have the gold and silver separated, the bars must be sent to the Vancouver, British Columbia plant. There, the bars go into reactors, the gold is dissolved out, the silver removed.
And then we're getting the pure gold and pure silver, ingots, casting grain, what have you.
A miner who brings their gold into Barrett's plant may either sell the unrefined material or give it to the company and receive ingots in return, from an eighth of an ounce on up to 400-ounce bullion blocks. All kinds of people come in for the service.
We get the occasional weekender who brings in half an ounce or whatever, but more so it's a professional miner. Well, he's got heavy equipment on the site, at least two or three claims that he's working at one time, but in Alaska this year, it's more the mom and pop type operation that's really getting going, and a lot of folks out there.
Those folks bring in as little as half an ounce.
I'd rather not say the top end.
That gold, regardless of form or quantity, is assayed, then lumped with gold brought in by other miners when it gets to the Vancouver refinery. A person who brings in their dust or flakes and requests 8 1/8-ounce ingots for their grandchildren, for example, will not get their own gold back.
But gold is gold, you know, no matter where it comes from. It comes out of the reactor, it's 99.95% pure. And about the only thing we'll be able to do, possibly, for a client, is to separate Alaskan gold from, say, Canadian gold, California gold.
That gold sent in by miners is not likely to include Dan Barrett. He's a former banker and only pans for gold occasionally and unsuccessfully. So it's not the miner's type of gold fever that prompted him to open shop.
In a sense, there's a gold rush on right now, and we felt that it was time to put something locally in the Fairbanks area.
River is climbing, big nuggets they're finding, north to Alaska, they're going north, the rush is on.
Karen McPherson in Fairbanks.
It was time to put something locally in the Fairbanks area.
Dictionaries and telephone directories go from A to Z, but compiling a telephone directory is a much less awesome task than writing a dictionary. Essentially, you list everyone that has a telephone in a prescribed format. Formats for dictionaries are only partly predetermined, and the manner and number of entries is limited only by the time, energy, and abilities of the editor. One dictionary editor is Edna McLean of the Alaska Native Language Center at the University of Alaska in Fairbanks. Since 1975, she and her assistants have been working on a dictionary of the Inupiaq language, the northern Eskimo language spoken with dialectical variations by residents of Alaska's North Slope, Canada, Greenland, and Siberia. McLean's dictionary differs from, say, Webster's or the Oxford English Dictionary. Unlike those two examples, which provide definitions of words for speakers of the language, the Inupiaq dictionary is intended to be used in schools to teach and maintain the language for Eskimos who are likely to be more fluent in English than Inupiaq.
There'll be an English into Inupiaq index, okay. But the bulk of the dictionary is going to be in Inupiaq into English, where you look up an Inupiaq word like the word for either, and there'll be a definition of it in there, like walrus.
Okay, but in English. Okay.
But in English. So it's not a Inupiaq to Inupiaq dictionary. Uh-huh. Okay.
Are there any words that have given you a particular problem?
There have been some words that we've run across in Inupiaq that we've had difficulty explaining in English. Like, for instance, the first word in the dictionary is aruk, and the entry that we have in the dictionary is AA-, and we're trying to get the definition or the meaning of just that stem. And it means to cry violently, becoming physically rigid, followed by temporary unconsciousness due to interrupted breathing. And that action is usually of a baby. Okay. Mm-hmm. So he's having a temper tantrum, but it was an action that we really couldn't use the English language, you know, with one word, temper tantrum, mm-hmm. to describe.
Are there certain things about the Inupiaq language that make it such that it is, that creates that problem?
Oh, yes. The one portion of the dictionary is going to be on what we call demonstratives. And these words are very special in the Eskimo language because they're used to point their location words as well as identifiers, you know. Like in English, you have the words this and that to identify an object in space, in a certain position. When you say this, it's close to you, or that may be away from the speaker but closer to the English.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, or away from both of you. In Inupiaq, we have 22 stems, which make it up to about over 500 demonstratives that we have for objects in space. And since you have only two words to explain those things in English, then we have to make the definitions quite long. And one example of this is a word like the word kanna. Okay. When you say kanna, then the person conceptualizes something that is below the speaker and the listener. And it may be in a container, but you can see it, and it's not moving. Okay. So, and in contrast to that would be the word samna. When you use samna, then you're referring to an object which is also below you, but you can't see it, and you don't know whether it's moving or being still.
Mm-hmm. The 500 demonstratives are but one of the unique aspects of the Inupiaq language.
The verb is also a simple sentence. Okay. But in the dictionary for Inupiaq in Alaska, we've concentrated on isolating the verbs. And since we're doing that, we've also had to work on isolating what we call postbases.
Postbases are units that contain meaning in themselves, morphemes. They cannot be used as stems to combine with an ending to form a word. In the word Aniaktuk, the postbase is Neak. To find Inupiaq postbases, McLean has been going through stories and published books. For the dictionary, words are broken into stems, postbases, and endings with corresponding sections for each element.
So to look up something in this dictionary, what you have to do is, after you've heard a word, you have to say, ah, the first part of that was, mm-hmm. then I heard, and then the last sound that I heard was, and look up all those three sections?
Yes, you have to. And it'll be impossible for a person who hasn't had Inupiaq grammar or who's not aware of how an Inupiaq word is put together uh-huh. to use the dictionary.
I personally cannot imagine sitting down and making a dictionary. It's just incomprehensible to me.
Sometimes we want to throw the whole thing away. No, I shouldn't say that. But it's the, you have to make everything so precise and make sure that the definition that you're working on is going to satisfy majority of the people.
Eskimo linguist Edna McLean, who is compiling a dictionary for the people of the North, an Inupiaq Eskimo dictionary. I'm Karen McPherson in Fairbanks. The 130 miles of road separating Fairbanks from the Usabelli coal mine leads south through some of the most spectacular scenery on the park's highway between Fairbanks and Anchorage. Tall, well-formed spruce trees, aspen and birch groves, scenic pullouts for gazing over the Tanana Valley and the river winding through the flats, the Alaska Range and Denali as a backdrop, and then butted up against Mount McKinley National Park near the small community of Healy, it's Alaska's only operating coal mine, an open pit mine about 20,000 acres in all, run by Joe Usabelli and founded by his father in 1918. Although most of the attention on Alaska's energy resources is focused on oil, a 1975 report prepared for the State Department of Natural Resources stated that at that time there were 132.9 billion tons of readily mineable coal, plus 1.9 trillion tons of hypothetical coal resources. Coal production, President Carter said recently, should be increased. But Joe Usabelli contends that federal regulation of the industry is so intense that instead of providing a stable, inexpensive source of fuel, prices are now around $20 a ton, coal prices will continue to go up in response to the cost of complying with those regulations. Some of those cost increases are associated with the salaries paid to the people who fill out the forms.
Our engineering, approximately half of our engineering staff, time is devoted to preparing data that will be given to the government, which we really don't need ourselves.
How many governmental departments do you actually have to deal with?
It's funny you should ask. I give a speech on that. I've given twice now. 2 years ago, I gave it, and we counted. At that time, we dealt directly with 45 different government agencies. In the 2 years from that till I gave it again about a month and a half ago, it's gone up to 61. Now, that's frightening.
Some of those agencies regulate safety requirements.
Our equipment is required to have backup alarms. You don't really need a backup alarm. People know they're there. It's very noisy. Matter of fact, the backup alarm has to be sufficiently loud that it is greater than the noise standard we're supposed to meet. We have certain black lung payments that we're required to make. Well, in an open pit mine of this type, nobody gets black lung. That's an underground disease. But we still have to pay, I think it's 25 cents a ton to the federal government to pay for all this black lung. And people are just assumed to have it, whether they have it or not. It's just a bad law. I mean, when people have it, certainly we need to do something about that. But the way the government has approached it is all wrong, and like everything they do.
The target of Usabelli's anger is the 40-page Surface Mining and Control Act of 1977 and the more than 1,000 pages of attendant, detailed, inflexible regulations, such as those concerning reforestation and the handling of topsoil, an especially touchy area given Usabelli's 10 years of experimentation with reforesting, well in advance of the federal regulations. To illustrate how misguided he felt those restrictions were, he pointed to the overburden, a mound of grayish soil resembling a lunar landscape.
See the topsoil, which is from anywhere from maybe from nothing in a lot of areas to maybe a foot, most of it frozen, which makes it very sour. You can see the type of growth we get here, the little scrubby trees, a little brush. If you dig through there, you'll find a root structure that goes down maybe 8 inches. We find that by not using the topsoil, we don't restrict the root growth to that little thin layer. We can, by using a proper seed mixture and proper fertilizer, that we can grow in almost anything. I had grass growing in my boat trailer. We had it growing in the back of the airplane. Grow almost anywhere.
Those seeds that will grow almost anywhere violate federal regulations, regulations that state seeding may only be done from seeds of indigenous plants, plants that don't grow as well, if enough seeds could be found, as the variety selected by the agronomist hired by Usabelli. Not that the land and the requirement that it be returned to its original state is held sacred.
Wait until I finally kind of have an idea what next week's orders are.
Okay, let me explain a little bit here about what's happening. Why it's called strip mining, because you're running a strip. In this case, about 100 feet wide. A little wider at this point, because we're trying to straighten the pit out. But normally, we'll run about a 100-foot wide cut. Now, where they're stacking the coal, or the dirt, I mean, was coal before. We mined last year. So now the coal that you see here to the end there, will be mined this year. Next year, we'll come in, the dirt behind us will go back in this hole. So in effect, we're shifting all the overburden in this area to the north, about 100 feet. Of course, then when we're done, the top, that will leave piles, rows, ridges, if you want to call them that, which we'll then level off and reseed it. So the ground will be back pretty much like it was to begin with. The approximate original contour is what the law says. I'm not exactly sure I know what that means. I'm not exactly sure they know what that means. But yeah, it'll conform very closely to the original terrain. Not that that is very sacred to me. It's very sacred to them, but not necessarily. I don't see it. Man is so minuscule that it's hard to believe. Look at Mount St. Helens. We're just a flea on the behind of the world.
That flea who runs Usabelli Coal Mine Incorporated intends to keep on bothering the world, or at least the 45 federal agencies that prompt him to conform, that cause him so much annoyance.
The government does not recognize uniqueness. They don't recognize uniqueness in people either.
The patch on the back of Joe Usabelli's cap says, "I'd rather be flying," but from what he says, it's apparent he'd rather be mining his way. I'm Karen McPherson in Fairbanks. This is a suggested APRN lead. There's a summer festival going on in Fairbanks. The festivities began Tuesday morning with a sourdough pancake feed and will end Sunday with a boat race and baseball game. The event, called Golden Days, is intended to celebrate Fairbanks during the Gold Rush era. Felix Pedro is credited with the discovery of gold in 1902, just north of town, and gold mining is still actively pursued. Modern-day gold miners received their due during Golden Days yesterday with a gold panning competition. Karen McPherson was there and filed this report. And now we get to the real piece.
Fairbanks, 1980, Golden Days Championship Gold Panning Contest title.
Now, who has the title now?
This will be the first annual. Hopefully, they'll carry on it next year. I'll be back for another trophy.
Well, what do you mean back for another trophy? You already have one?
Well, Alaska Champion Gold Panner, 1980, down there July the 6th, out of Juneau, Alaska. How do you like that?
What's your name?
Prospector John.
Prospector John cajoled the small crowd of mostly tourists to enter the competition, only there weren't any real competitors, any sourdoughs or real prospectors, so the tourists provided the competition. Entrants needed a gold pan and a gold nugget. The object was to fill up the gold pan with gravel, hide the nugget, and then pan for that planted piece of gold, not to actually find gold from scratch. Prospector John had his gold with him, an enormous nugget that he kept wrapped in a piece of paper. The bigger-than-life-size nugget matched the rest of him, a big man wearing worn leather boots, suspenders on his pants, a black hat shaped in the style seen in the old photos of gold miners in the early part of this century, and holes in his gums where teeth used to be. How did you get to be a person who does this kind of thing?
Well, anybody can, really. I mean, it's the most simple, basic tool of prospecting there is, the gold pan.
What's the secret of using a gold pan right?
Separate what you don't want, sand and gravel generally, from gold, which you obviously would be looking for.
Yeah, but you just said I was shaking hands with your champion right hand. There's got to be something
That's
more
right.
to it than
That's
just shaking it around.
Champion gold panner, because by one gold nugget, I took the championship away from what was formerly a Alaska champion gold panner, my good friend Al Kukta out of Juneau. He's no more champion gold panner, not for the rest of this year. That's me.
Most people pan gold to get gold. Why are you panning it just to get a championship?
Well, what do you mean? I've already got my gold. What are you arguing about? Hey, is anybody here going to challenge your Golden Days champion?
I'm challenging.
You will. You got your gold pan?
I'll get one here.
You got a gold? You got a gold nugget to use of your own?
No.
What kind of a challenge you call that, then, huh?
There were finally three challengers. A fellow named Roger, who said he'd tried panning twice before, a young man in rubber boots who'd tried his hand in some Fairbanks creeks earlier in the day, and a woman from California whose painted toenails glistened through the water in which she'd be panning.
Hey, how come you don't fill that?
What do you mean?
At least level full.
Oh,
rocks
in there. That's all rocks in there.
That's right, level full. Come on. You can't. You see, because that you won't see the nugget when you're...
You're telling me I won't get it. Be in your other hand. No.
That's right. Now, fill that up level full, you guys. Hey, from North Carolina. Get over there and fill that up.
Have you ever done this before?
Never in my life.
And what possessed you to do it now?
John, Prospect John. His enticing personality.
Contester Roger, who was also filling up his borrowed gold pan with gravel, came from Michigan. In the times you have tried panning before, you had any success?
No, I'm afraid not. Just iron pyrites is all I wind up with.
Well, how come you're entering this contest?
Just try to take his title away. Jeez. Somebody's got to have it, I guess.
How do you rate your chances?
Slim to none.
The California woman used a friend's gold pendant in the shape of a bee for her nugget. The young man in rubber boots used some flakes he'd found that day, and the man from Michigan borrowed flakes from that other fellow, and Prospector John had his gold rock. Wouldn't it be an unfair advantage for one person to have a big nugget and another one to have just a little one?
Are you kidding? What are you talking about? How much do I lose if I lose the bigger one as compared to a little one?
The object isn't to lose
How
it,
about
it's to
the
get
color?
It faster,
That's
isn't it?
That's right, and you're...
Well, can't you find
hey,
that one a little bit faster than, you know, one like that?
Well, I hope to do just exactly that.
So you're stacking the deck.
No!
But Prospector John's three challengers thought he was doing just that. Even against Chichacos, the man really wanted to win. But those Chichacos prevailed, and John wrapped up his enormous nugget, put it in his pocket, and borrowed some flakes from another contestant.
You see the disadvantage you're putting me at? You're really turning us around to a disadvantage for me, ain't you?
But that was hardly the case.
Everybody, get your position at the creek here. My position is staked out with the gold pan there. I've got me a nice spot at the gold pan part here. So that's so. Now you guys find you a place that you're going to be happy panning with. And don't start panning till Mary gives you a signal to pan.
At the count of three, the four contestants began swilling the water around the gravel that filled their gold pans, dumping out rocks, looking for the gold that was buried among the debris. The first to find their gold would win. The crowd pressed forward, all two dozen or so who stayed around, and Prospector John really worked. He threw the pan in the air, flicking it with his wrists, looking intently for that color. He found it, just a few seconds before the fellow in rubber boots did, and for his efforts, John received a plaque proclaiming him the 1980 Fairbanks Golden Days Gold Panning Champion.
You proud of your title?
Well, as 1980 Golden Days Fairbanks Champion Gold Panner, absolutely.
You going to be back next year to defend your title?
Hey, for sure. All I want is bigger and better trophies.
Prospector John from Skagway, who won a little trophy in the Golden Days Gold Panning Championship. I'm Karen McPherson in Fairbanks.